to agree to a truce, albeit temporary, and a captive swap?
Well, I think they definitely want a fig leaf, and Joe Biden and Joe Biden's team is in, they realize they're in big trouble because the majority of the population in the U.S. and even more so in the Democratic Party are supporting a ceasefire. So they're out on a limb, but they're so beholden to Zionist forces in the United States that they have to do this dance where they pretend to be calling and pushing for a ceasefire and abhorring the slaughter going on there. But at the same time, they want to give Israel more time to try to achieve their goal, which is not achievable.
Exactly. And of course, they continue to veto UN Security Council resolutions calling for an immediate ceasefire, not to mention the continuing flow of American weapons and money to Israel. Tarek, let me come to you for the next one. How does all of this make you feel, that, you know, more than 5 months on, 152 days on, 30,000, more than 30,000 people killed, more than 72,000 people wounded, and yet not an immediate permanent ceasefire?
I don't know, you know, what words there are left to describe the situation in Gaza right now and the situation in Palestine. Every combination of condemnation and visual imagery and visual description has been used. Every poet has used every last, you know, description they can think of. And I'm not going to better describe that. We, as all Palestinians, as all, you know, people who are seeing it, you know, seeing a genocide unfold with, you know, with our own eyes on camera, on Instagram, on social media, whilst our political class are 100% backing it, we've completely been lost for words. There's nothing that can describe it better than
what kind of action will you take? Because we're in an election year, not just here in the UK, but in the States and more than 50 other countries. When you see this dithering on the part of the political class here, as you put it, be it the conservatives or Labour, someone as young as you and the likes of you out there, how will you get back at these people in power who can stop a genocide but won't or haven't so far?
Well, very simply, I would refuse to vote for any of these supposed representative parties. You know, many people make the comment that if I was to not vote for Keir Starmer or Labour, that would make a conservative leadership more likely. The very simple fact is that if we're going to profess to be in a democracy, then I have every right to have a party that represents me. If we are in a professed democracy, why am I being forced and practically to vote for people who we all know don't represent me and have no intention of representing me and the vast majority of the British public, which, as I'm sure you understand, 67%, I believe.
66%.
Support an immediate ceasefire. And yet, like you were saying, there's a complete, you know, undemocratic and extremist attitude towards this that has justified, as we speak, the genocide of my people. And I'm not going to, you know, vote or put my support behind anyone that hasn't done everything in their power possible to stop that.
And the rise in the number of independent candidates and minor parties is probably going to put an end to that political duopoly in Westminster.
Well, I hope so.
That is the hope. Rick, we've passed 150 days, as I mentioned earlier, of this relentless bombardment. What is your assessment of where things stand?
Well, in 1967, the U.S. launched a surprise attack on its Arab neighbors, and in 6 days, they were able to decimate the air forces of those neighbors and win that war. In contrast, we've got 150 days or five full months of Israeli slaughter, massacre, and killing, and they are nowhere near achieving their goals. The Palestinian resistance has withstood this onslaught, this slaughter, and I think the Israeli government is desperate because they can see that their goal of winning a quick victory is not being achieved. They can see that the world is increasingly turning against them, even the West, so that the U.S. is you know, almost alone. They're not entirely alone. Germany and the U.K. and France are still supporting them, but less and less so. So the pressure is building, and Netanyahu is desperate, and in a way the U.S. is desperate to see this come to an end.
He sure is desperate. There's, of course, divisions inside the Israeli so-called war cabinet. We'll talk about that in a little later in the program. But meantime, the U.S., Qatar, and Egypt have been attempting to hammer out a ceasefire agreement, at least on the look of it, for a number of weeks with seemingly little progress, despite early optimism. Earlier this week, the Egyptian Foreign Minister Sameh Shoukry met his Dutch counterpart for talks where the fate of the negotiations was outlined.
The negotiations are sensitive. I can't say there is optimism or pessimism, but we haven't reached yet a point at which we can achieve a ceasefire. But it is important that everyone understands the importance of achieving this and to take responsibility for the decisions to be taken in this regard. There must be a clear political will that goes along with this. And some countries have abilities, like the United States of America. And there is a development there in the remarks that were said by the American Vice President last night when she spoke about the importance of an immediate ceasefire.
Rick, let me come to you for this one as well. The Israelis have not bothered to send any negotiators to these talks going on in Cairo. Does this tell you just how little regard they have for the whole process?
Well, it's an indicator, and it's going to be interesting to see what they report back to the International Court of Justice, because they're coming up on the deadline where they have to report. Meanwhile, their overlords in Washington are in deep trouble. Just as in British politics, we're seeing upheavals with George Galloway winning a landslide victory. 7 days ago, we had a Democratic Party primary race in Michigan, which is a very key state in the United States election process, and over 100,000. Registered Democrats voted uncommitted. So this is a sign. Ideologically, Biden is a Zionist. He's dependent on Zionist funds, and yet most of the party is not feeling that way and is increasingly wondering what the heck is going on. So it's the same thing as your guest from Britain was saying, where this, you know, increasingly a contradiction between democracy and what we're seeing in reality.
Do those electoral developments in the States perhaps explain the Biden administration's eagerness to claim victory in some kind of a temporary truce?
I think they would be very happy to have that happen. But it's a bit of a smokescreen, because they're talking about, just like you say, a temporary truce. And whereas other people are saying that we need to have a ceasefire that stops it once and for all.
Correct. And Tariq, Egypt, one of the parties to these ongoing negotiations, could they do more? And could the Arab bloc overall do more to bring an end to this?
I think there's a lot they can do to alleviate the suffering that Gazans are going through at the moment. The borders are still not as open as they should be. There's still not enough aid getting through. And I don't want to say that's the fault of Egypt in so much as it's the fault of the Egyptian leadership, which is an important distinction to make. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I think we can all agree that Egyptian leadership, just as much of the Arab leadership, is not at all representative of the population and the people in these countries. What we are definitely seeing is a very lackluster response. I think all of us Arab Palestinians are utterly disappointed in what has been, you know, little more than words and messages and a couple, nothing more than sort of virtual signalling sort of, you know, technical achievements of airdropping some limited amounts of aid.
Yeah.
When we're talking about the mass starvation of 2 million people right at their border. So, of course, there's more they can do. So what they could have done over the past, not just since 7th of October, but for the past 50 years or so, that they've sat idly, or, well, maybe not completely idly,
yeah,
but for the current regime, yeah, I mean, the current regime has sat idly by as they've seen their brothers across the border under siege for decades now. And I can't say I'm surprised, but I'm definitely disappointed.
And yet some of them normalised ties
with
apartheid Israel
Egypt,
too,
course,
didn't they?
Jordan have normalised ties with Israel.
UAE, yeah.
Yeah, and they've used that, of course, as an excuse.
All right, let me cross over to California again. Rick, we'll highlight in a little more detail the position of Washington in these talks later in the program once again, but highlight for me the impact that is having on the presidential race again. Especially for Joe Biden's campaign and the likelihood, so it seems, of Donald Trump going head-to-head with Joe Biden and what that would mean for the Palestinians.
Well, unfortunately, the Palestinians are between a rock and a hard place there, because Donald Trump, while he's very different than Joe Biden on Ukraine and Russia, he, of course, is horrible on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and he's as beholden as Biden is to Zionist pro-Israel forces in the United States. So we're looking at a pretty grim picture there. Really the hope has to be in the United States that we can see third parties and alternative parties, such as George Galloway's tremendous victory the other day, appearing and offering an alternative. Because right now, for many, many decades in the United States, there's been no difference in foreign policy between the Republicans and the Democrats. Yeah. They may differ and be at odds and at war on domestic issues, but when it comes to foreign policy, it's one foreign policy, and one of that's not pretty, and that's a domination and supporting in the Middle East, supporting Israel. And so that's our reality. Things are, and, I think, it's approaching a breakup point, though.
Yeah, and that's what they say about the mainstream political parties here, too, the conservatives and labor, that they are not different in terms of their approach to the Middle East and to the Israel-Palestine issue. But let me take a moment to let our viewers know, if they have just joined us, that this is Gaza Under Attack, a deep dive into the news surrounding the ongoing U.S.-led Israeli genocidal war on Gaza, the blockaded coastal enclave. You mentioned George Galloway, Rick, the pro-Palestinian politician. George Galloway has caused a panic in British politics with his landslide win in the by-elections held in Rochdale, Greater Manchester, which accorded him a mandate to speak about Gaza in the House of Commons of the British Parliament. Galloway told us it's time small parties challenged big ones.
A genocide is not a small thing. And the International Court of Justice has already sent Israel for trial, having concluded that there was a plausible case for genocide being committed in the Gaza Strip. That's not a small thing. That doesn't happen every day. But the local politicians here in the council and the national politicians across the consensus of the front benches want to pretend that it isn't happening, want to disguise that they are deeply involved in it. They're giving cover to it and even given military collaboration with it. So, you know, I always put it to the journalists who implicitly criticize me for raising this genocide. If this by-election was taking place in 1940, when Hitler was building death camps for the Jews, would anyone have criticized me for highlighting it in a by-election campaign? Of course, the truthful answer is many of them still would have, because much of the British media was highly supportive of the rise of Hitler and Mussolini. It must spark a rethink, even if not publicly acknowledged, that the people are not with the government, they're not with the opposition. So what does that mean? Means we need a new opposition, means we need a new government. And that's where we come in. We are offering a program, and the independents that we will ally with are offering a different approach, and suddenly it will become possible for real meaningful political change. You know, big parties can become small. Look at PASOK in Greece, for example, or the so-called French Socialist Party of Mitterrand and Hollande. They are minuscule now. Big parties can become small, and small parties can become big.
The United States are the chief architect of the bombardment of Gaza, yet have a pivotal role in the negotiations. Here are some words of the U.S. State Department spokesperson on the Biden administration's approach to the talks and why Washington remains optimistic. A deal can still be done.
Israel has to be careful that in achieving a tactical victory, it doesn't endure a strategic defeat, and it remains our advice to them not to do that. In our view, the obstacles are not surmountable. In our view, should be possible to reach an agreement. We think the proposal that Israel put on the table in consultation with the United States and with Qatar and Egypt is one that Hamas should agree to, and it's one that would alleviate the suffering of the Palestinian people and bring about an immediate ceasefire for 6 weeks. And so we think that agreement can be reached.
We have a few more minutes to go. Let's continue the conversation with Tariq Othman and Rick Sterling. And Tariq, let's take each of those sound bites one at a time. George Galloway winning the by-election in Rochdale. You alluded to it earlier on, but could this be a message nationally to a bigger audience out there, bigger number of voters out there comes the general election, this win, stumping victory by George Galloway?
Definitely, and the message is very clear. The message is very clear for everyone to see that the traditional parties no longer represent us as British people. Not just, by the way, on the issue of Gaza, but we've seen the complete, indifference of both parties to all sorts of issues of poverty and economy here in the UK. And we've seen that the people in this country are simply fed up. And part of that, of course, is we're seeing George Galloway win. But what's also very crucial is that second place was neither Labour nor Conservatives. I believe it was David Tullier, an independent candidate. Mm-hmm. So what we're seeing is a complete, the demise of the traditional party structure here in the UK, specifically in Rochdale. But what it could be is a sort of bad omen for these politicians and the leaders of these parties if they don't change tact.
Speaking of changing tack, Benny Gantz, a member of the Israeli war cabinet, is here to meet David Cameron, probably the prime minister. And all we've heard from David Cameron saying that Israel is an occupying power, that it has a duty under international law to provide aid, that the situation is dreadful, meaning in the Gaza Strip, and people were starving to death. That's all we're getting from the Foreign Secretary of the UK. No canceling of arms license or anything like that to the Israeli regime. What do you make of that?
I think it's very representative of what the British government, what their policy has been so far. I think it's very reminiscent of a tactic in U.S. and Israeli media of shoot and cry, or that's how the saying goes, of you participate and actively encourage the death of people, and simultaneously shed tears for those that you've murdered. Israelis will do it when they pretend like the thousands of dead children are simply, that they when they pretend that they mourn for those children when they clearly don't.
And just we saw the Americans airdrop aid into the Gaza Strip.
And we have, you know, Americans and British politicians time and time again saying that enough, you know, too many people have died, but will simultaneously provide weapons to encourage the killing of more people.
Absolutely. Let me put one final question to Rick. And Rick, the Biden administration, it is argued, is bargaining above anything else for a grand bargain, rather, that would include Palestinian statehood, security guarantees, and recognition of Israel by Saudi Arabia. As Palestinian statehood, of course, firmly opposed by the current Prime Minister Netanyahu. Is any of that achievable?
Well, we can just look at history, because they've been, you know, talking about one version or another of the two-state solution for, you know, for 50 years. And where are we? You know, beyond the need for a ceasefire, which, you know, is, of course, the first priority, we've got apartheid in Israel, and we've got the occupation. And, you know, there has to be some, the issue has to be dealt with sooner than later, because it's gone on, it's festered for all these years, and it's come to this. The United States, you know, has really shown itself. It's not an honest broker. There's some other international forces need to play the leading role here.
All right. Thank you for that. That is all the time we have. My thanks to our guest, Tara Ruthman, here in the studio with me, and Rick Sterling. Until next time, continue to keep Palestine in your hearts. Goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In Gaza, every fishing trip is a brush with death for the Palestinian fishermen setting out at dawn in small wooden boats. Since the Zionist regime's war on Gaza, the regime's restrictions have only grown tighter, and the danger of providing food for 2.2 million starving Palestinians has grown exponentially. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East I wrote, every morning at daybreak, Mahmoud Hamada pushed his boat out to sea knowing he may never return. He told Middle East I last month on the beach in central Gaza's Deir al-Balah, you can fish during the early hours, but you know for sure that you will be shot at once it approaches noon. Gaza's 4,000 fishermen are a backbone of the Palestinian enclave's society, providing fresh fish despite severe restrictions on fishing that the Zionist regime has placed on Gaza's waters. Since the Zionist regime's war on Gaza, those restrictions have only grown tighter, and the danger of providing food for 2.2 million starving Palestinians has grown exponentially. Hamada said, "You have a limited space that might be safe to fish in. If you go further, an Israeli ship will approach and kill you. I have been working for more than 20 years as a fisherman, but I have never gone through such a time. I just wish this war ends very soon, because we've been bleeding for 5 months, and we can't bear it anymore." 2 weeks later, Hamada was shot dead as he tried to rescue a 9-year-old child under the Zionist regime fire. Hamada's son, Muhammad 15, watched his father's killing. He told MEE, "The sniper shot the child twice in his neck, and his head fell off his body. My father tried to take his corpse. The least he could do. Unfortunately, a tank shot him in his head, annihilating his skull." The father's aide once had a workshop near his house in Gaza City's Ashati refugee camp. Full of tools, he'd collected over 2 decades of work. Both were completely destroyed by the Zionist regime's bombardment, and Hamada and his family were living in a tent in Deir al-Balah when he was killed. Hamada told MEE before his death, "We are literally fighting for our existence, which is fading gradually." Hamada's death shows nowhere is safe for Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Yet, with the Zionist regime allowing barely any aid into the war-torn enclave, leading to at least 17 people dying of starvation, and NGOs and a UN expert warning of a looming famine, the particularly perilous job of fishermen has never been more important. Imad Al-Aghra, a fisherman from Deir al-Balah, said he has been shot at about 20 times in recent months. He told MEE, "Every time I was attacked directly by the Israeli Navy. I know it's life-threatening, but how can I live if I don't make a living through my profession as a fisherman?" Aghra and his fellow fishermen use small, simple boats made of wood or plastic. Their oars are homemade. He said, "Sometimes we use our hands instead. Once we get in the sea, the military ship approaches and starts shooting us. But why? We're just fishermen." Before the October 7th events, Palestinian fishermen were allowed to fish 6 miles off Gaza coast, though that limited the size and variety of fish that Palestinians could catch. Fishermen, nonetheless, were able to provide Gazan dinner tables with sardines, prawns, tuna, octopus, and much more. Today, much less of the coastal waters is accessible, and catches are more meager as a result. Aghra said he gets about 2 or 3 kilograms of fish a day now, around a quarter of what he caught before the war. He said, "The maximum distance we can get to is around 400 meters. Every day is a different challenge. You may be attacked at 10 meters, 50 meters, 200 meters, or 400 meters, but it's impossible to get further. Once you're seen, you can hear the echo of bullets hitting your boat. Most of the time, we have to get off our boats and swim to survive. It's so terrifying." Last month, Aghra's relative was killed by the Zionist regime's gunfire as he was out fishing, shot twice in the neck. The man who was with him is still in intensive care, and there is no guarantee that enduring all this will result in a catch at all, Aghra said. "Most of the days, we get nothing. What can you tell your starving family when you come back empty-handed? It's so painful." The Zionist regime's war on Gaza has killed more than 30,000 Palestinians and created a humanitarian crisis. Recently, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, said about 97 trucks of aid were entering Gaza a day last month, down from 150 in January. The agency says 508 trucks are needed a day to meet Palestinians' acute needs. As food becomes scarcer, its prices rise. Hossein Al-Ramlavi, a father of four from Gaza City's Al-Tofah district, currently displaced to Deir al-Balah, said it's difficult to find any fish on the market. He told MEE, "What is found is so little. The fish is so expensive. For example, you can buy a kilo of prawns for $45, but it's simply unaffordable."
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be looking at a very important and significant question. And that question is about prohibited places of patronization. And this question is very significant because, you know, especially for the youth, because young people, they like to come, they get to get together with one another, go outside, sit in, you know, different places and talk with one another, which they, in their, you know, in their language, they call it hanging out, right? So a lot of times youth who are very religious or who want to adhere to the tenets of Islam and the rules of Islam, sometimes they inquire and they ask about whether, you know, this is okay, it's halal, there's nothing haram about it in hanging out or in getting together. Or they might inquire as to what places should we avoid, you know, gathering in and patronizing in. So let's examine this question today. Let's begin by examining a verse of the Holy Quran. In this verse of the Holy Quran, Allah Ta'ala, He presents us with a general rule in which you know, He presents a general criteria by means of which we can assess whether it's okay to sit in a certain place or not. In this verse, Allah says, "Certainly He has sent down to you in the book that when you hear Allah's signs being disbelieved and derided, do not sit with them until they engage in some other discourse." So if we go to a place and we see that Allah's signs, His ayat, which is a Quranic concept, if His signs are being falsified, are being denied, are being derided, are being mocked and ridiculed, then this is a sign that we should get up and leave from that place until you know whatever their discourse that was going on regarding the signs of Allah. Until it doesn't finish. When it finishes, then yeah, we can rejoin the group and continue our conversation with them. Keeping in mind this general rule, we have some hadith which can be considered applications of that rule or instances of that general rule that was mentioned in the Holy Quran. In a hadith, it's been narrated that Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam said the following: "A believer must not sit in a place where Allah is disobeyed if he is unable to make a change." Right? So here Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he echoes the same theme that was mentioned in the Quran. He adds a certain clause here, and that is that if you feel you can change the situation, meaning you can, with your good exhortation and your amr bil ma'ruf and nahi anil munkar, by prohibiting the evil and enjoining the good, if you can change that situation and you know, encourage those people who are deriding the signs of Allah and denying them, to turn away from their evil actions, then it's okay for you to sit in that place and, you know, try to guide the people towards the truth. Otherwise, if you feel that you cannot, then it's better to get up and leave from there. In another hadith, it's been narrated that Imam Sadiq alayhi salam said, with respect to the verse that we read in the beginning, he said, it means that when you hear someone denying the truth and rejecting it, and the Imam specifically says, and speaking ill about the Imams alayhi salam, you should stand up and leave him and never sit with him again, no matter who he might be. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at prohibited places of patronization in the light of the Quran and the Hadith. Until next time, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy, in the program The Key on RIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
North Korea has strongly denounced South Korea's joint military exercises with the United States, while warning there would be dire consequences for Seoul for such actions. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. South Korea's Yonhap News Agency has covered this story and tells us more. South Korea and the United States have kicked off joint spring military exercises, doubling the number of participating troops compared to last year. The exercises, dubbed Freedom Shield, are being held from 4th to 14th of March. The military drills come as Seoul's defense ministry said on Monday, 4th of March, the two allies' air forces also launched their annual battalion-level Sangmak exercises for a five-day run. According to South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff, Freedom Shield will involve twice the number of troops from both sides compared to last year. They will conduct 48 rounds of combined field training, including air assaults and airstrikes. American strategic assets such as aircraft carrier and bombers could participate. The term strategic is often used to describe nuclear forces. The Allies claim that the exercises are aimed at countering North Korea's alleged nuclear and missile threats. However, Pyongyang says such military maneuvers amount to a rehearsal for invasion. North Korea, which has been under harsh sanctions by the United States and the United Nations Security Council for years over its nuclear and ballistic missile programs, launched an unprecedented number of missiles in 2022, including its most advanced intercontinental ballistic missile ever. North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un, has repeatedly said his government is building up its defensive military arsenal in preparation for war by the West that could break out at any time on the peninsula. Kim Jong-un also announced recently that North Korea's goal of reuniting the Korean Peninsula was over, as he described the South as its prime enemy. The Reuters news agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. North Korea has strongly denounced South Korea for its joint military drills with the United States, whilst warning there could be dire consequences for Seoul for such actions. A spokesman for North Korea's Ministry of National Defense said in a press statement on Monday, 4th of March, that the large-scale joint South Korea-US military exercises were provocative and aimed at increasing uncertainty in the region. The National Defense Ministry said in the press statement carried by North Korea's KCNA news agency, the drills included a plan for field maneuvers which doubled as against last year, and even the armed forces of 11 satellite countries under the so-called UN command, without any justification for existence, were mobilized. The statement added, "The large-scale war drills staged by the world's number one nuclear weapons state and more than 10 satellite states against the state in the Korean Peninsula, where a nuclear war may be ignited even with a spark, can never be called defensive." It called the military drills a frantic and reckless move, while condemning it as a military threat to a sovereign state, an attempt for invading it. It said the armed forces of the DPRK, North Korea, will continue to watch the adventurous acts of the enemies and conduct responsible military activities to strongly control the unstable security environment on the Korean Peninsula. It added that South Korea and the United States will be made to pay a dear price for their false choice while suffering the consequences that security uneasiness carries with it. Global News has also covered the same story and tells us more. North Korea has carried out a test of its underwater nuclear weaponry system in a demonstration against the joint military exercises conducted recently by United States and South Korea and Japan, which seriously threatened the security of Pyongyang. The state-owned Korean Central News Agency, KCNA, recently said Pyongyang tested the HIL-523, a nuclear-capable underwater drone, in the waters of its east coast. The underwater drone test, which was developing in the East Sea of Korea, came the second day after the US, South Korea, and Japanese navies held their three-day regular drills alongside the US aircraft carrier Carl Vinson. An unnamed spokesman for the Ministry of National Defense said in a statement, "We will never tolerate the reckless military confrontation hysteria. The US, Japan, and the Republic of Korea are getting frantic in their provocative military exercises from the outset of the year." The spokesman said, "Our Army's underwater nuclear-based countering posture is being further rounded off, and his various maritime and underwater responsive actions will continue to deter the hostile military maneuvers of the navies of the United States and its allies. Pyongyang will never condone the enemy's reckless military confrontation madness." He said, "We strongly condemn the reckless actions of the United States and its followers, and solemnly warn of the catastrophic consequences that will result from this." The Hael, which translates to tsunami in Korean, the new weaponry system was first put to trial last year in March, the objective of which was to carry out discrete assault in hostile maritime territories, effectively neutralizing naval strike formations and strategic ports by unleashing a substantial radioactive surge via an underwater detonation. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has said he no longer believed unification with South Korea was possible and called for constitutional change to identify the South as the number one hostile state towards North Korea. In a speech to the Supreme People's Assembly, North Korea's parliament, Kim Jong-un said he had concluded that unification with the South was no longer possible and that Seoul is seeking regime change and unification by absorption. The two Koreas ended their 1950-1953 war with a truce, but not a peace treaty. However, Kim Jong-un was quoted as saying by KCNA news agency, "We don't want war, but we have no intention of avoiding it." Kim Jong-un added, "In the event of war on the Korean Peninsula, I think it is also important to reflect on the issue of completely occupying, suppressing, and reclaiming South Korea and incorporating it into the territory of our republic." KCNA said that North Korea would close three agencies that oversee unification and inter-Korean tourism: the Committee for the Peaceful Reunification, the National Economic Cooperation Bureau, and the Mount Kumgang International Tourism Administration.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Last year, Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi visited three African countries, Kenya, Uganda, and Zimbabwe. During the historic visit, President Raisi witnessed the signing of bilateral cooperation agreements in economic, scientific, and educational sectors, among others. Immediate steps were taken to implement these agreements, and in this regard, Iran has granted full scholarships to Ugandan students to study in Iranian universities. The students will study diverse disciplines such as engineering, computer science, and business management. The Islamic Republic of Iran seeks to transfer technology to Africa and empower this continent that has for long suffered from exploitation by imperialist powers. Now, still on matters of technology transfer, Africa, a continent abundant in minerals, holds the key to the world's transition to a low-carbon energy future. Now, exploiting critical green energy transition minerals comes with challenges and opportunities. The export of raw materials has left the continent poor. Now, countries are working on their mineral value chain. Technical know-how is critical if mineral value addition is to take root in Africa. So, what are African countries doing to build local capacity for mineral value addition? Hello, I'm Mubarak Henia, and this is Africa Today. This week, we are focusing on Iran's academic cooperation with Uganda that has seen dozens of students from these East African countries obtaining scholarships to study in Iran. The second part of our show is on how African countries can take advantage of the high demand for energy transition minerals available across the continent by implementing value addition initiatives.
Iran-Uganda Academic Cooperation. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi visited Uganda last July as part of his three-nation Africa tour. During the visit, President Yoweri Museveni called upon Iran to consider investing in Uganda's oil and gas sector, specifically by providing assistance in the development of the country's oil refinery.
President Raisi responded to the request by the President of Uganda, saying Iran is ready to transfer its know-how in the oil sector to Uganda. Now, as part of this transfer of technology program, Iran has granted scholarships to Ghanaian students to study in Iran. For more on this scholarship program, we have contacted His Excellency Majid Safar, Iran's ambassador to Uganda. Thanks, Mr. Ambassador, for your time today.
Thank you so much. Thank you for giving me this opportunity again to talk about the bilateral relation between Iran and Uganda, especially regarding education.
Now, the Islamic Republic of Iran has granted scholarships to Ugandan students to study in Iran, as we've heard. Now, this is indeed a commendable step. Now, Mr. Ambassador, can you, first of all, elaborate on the number of students involved and the fields of study?
Yes, please. You know, in this round of cooperation, educational cooperation, Ahlul Bayt University of the Islamic Republic of Iran granted something like 70 scholarships to Ugandan students. Among the subjects that these students are going to study in Ahlul Bayt University, most of the subjects are, you know, engineering, and that is very important and interesting. The courses are like construction engineering, mechatronic engineering, computer engineering, which are very important for Ugandan students these days. Also, we have some social sciences and something like international relation, political relation, laws in some subjects of the law, also women studies, and management, commerce management, that are very important for Ugandan students these days. And we know that the Ugandan students would be happy for their studies in Iran.
The issue of gender parity is quite important, both in Uganda and in Iran. Therefore, Iran also pays special attention to women while awarding scholarships to foreign students. Mr. Ambassador elaborates on this.
The number of students are 70, and among them, around 20 to 25 of these students are among the ladies. And it is very important for a community like Uganda. And these ladies will study also among them, and most of them are going to study in Ahlul Bayt University for engineering, computer engineering, and also construction engineering, and also mechatronic is among them. And it is very interesting from this point of view.
Iranian universities are ranked highly globally. Recently, the Islamic World Science Citation Center released the World University Rankings 2024 report, which includes 69 Iranian universities, compared to 63 in 2022.
Iranian universities are gaining popularity due to the high academic standards, and for sure, many across the world will want to study in Iran. Now, Mr. Ambassador, Iranian universities, as we know, are among the best in the region. So what criteria was used to award these scholarships?
The organization in which we cooperate with them to nominate the students have advertised these scholarships in different medias. And they received so many applications from different parts of Uganda. And so many people have sent their documents, educational documents, to that organization. And then among them, they have selected something like, I think, close to 200 students. And then they have nominated and presented their documents, educational documents, to the embassy. And we have sent those documents to Tehran, to Ahlul Bayt University, and by considering their degrees, their qualifications, and different subjects that was important for the university, they have selected something like, as I've said, 70 students. And this is very important. We didn't present these scholarships to selected people. And this is very important. And the most important thing was the level of education.
Ugandan officials have urged students awarded scholarships to live responsibly and use the opportunity to better their lives in addition to receiving education. Now, Mr. Ambassador, what is your advice to these Ugandan students who are already in Iran pursuing their studies?
The program for these students to see them off while they have been going to departure from Uganda to Tehran, I have told them that you should try to do your best because the universities in Iran are in very high level. You will receive a high-level education in different fields that you want to study in Iran. Therefore, they are sure that you will be another person regarding the level of your education. And you should be very helpful to Ugandan community and try to help the Ugandan people to work in the subjects that you are specialized in and to cooperate with the other, for example, foreign companies, to cooperate with them and try to bring the level of your activities in Uganda. While they are studied in universities, they are high-level educated people in different subjects, therefore they can create job opportunities.
The bilateral ties between Iran and Uganda are expected to expand, especially after the successful visit by Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi to Uganda last year.
And our last question, Mr. Ambassador, how will these scholarships boost Iran-Uganda bilateral relations, especially in the economic sector?
As you have mentioned and referred to the visits by the President of the Islamic Republic of Iran to Uganda, in the meetings between our two presidents, especially President Museveni, referred that we want to cooperate with Iran, for example, in refineries. We need refineries, and Iran is very professional in construction and installation of the refineries. And there are Iranian companies that are ready to cooperate in Uganda and to have some sort of activities in Uganda. And then if we have Iranian refineries installed in Uganda, then we have the possibility to export crude oil and then to produce different type of oil products, which are necessary in Ugandan market. And they are importing now. And even we can refine the Ugandan crude oil that in near future would be explored, and also the Ugandans are trying to export their crude oils. We can help them in these fields. And refining the oil, crude oil is also very important. And Iranian companies could be helpful in this field with Uganda, and not only to use it inside Uganda, but to cover the regional markets. All of this type of cooperation needs people who are professional in these fields, and this type of educational cooperation between Iran and Uganda would be much, much helpful in very near future, we hope.
And I'd like to thank Ambassador Majid Safar, Iran's ambassador to Uganda, for his insight on the scholarships awarded to Ugandan students who are already in Iran pursuing their studies. And now to continue our discussion on the academic collaboration between Iran and Africa, we are joined by Hussein Abdullahi, a Nigerian PhD student at the Faculty of Biology, University of Tehran. Thanks a lot for your time, Mr. Abdullahi. Now, first, tell us what motivated you to pursue your studies in Iran.
The reasons for coming to Iran for study are many. But the most important is the influence of my friend who came here to study in Tehran University of Medical Science in the name of Professor Rogo, who came here and studied. He has already explained to me a lot of things about the capability of the Iranian education and its quality. And therefore, I felt very, very interested to be here and study in this very important University of Tehran.
Let's now talk about academic standards. Mr. Abdullahi, How are the academic standards at the University of Tehran and Iran in general, particularly considering the fact that you also studied at high-ranking Nigerian universities?
What I can say here is that, of course, the standard of education here in the university, most especially in the University of Tehran, is very, very, very good.
Now, the quality of life and social integration is also important for foreign students in any country.